listening to The Sector, the radio show podcast discussing nonprofit, social justice, and activism. With me, your host, Ethan Clow, and broadcasting, as always, here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Well, it's Friday once again, the end of the week, and hopefully looking forward to some nice sunny weather over the weekend. In fact, it's been really nice the last couple of days here in Vancouver. The sun is shining, is warm, there's a nice breeze, it's not too hot, not too cold. Very nice weather for September, with school back in session. Very nice. Unlike, of course, our good pals in Calgary, where they received about 1 billion feet of snow the last few days. I mean, remarkable, really. Only a couple of days away from August, and they're getting a snowstorm in Calgary. I mean, just wow. Certainly makes us happy to live in Vancouver, the land of sensible weather. Well, enough with the mocking of Calgary. And we love Calgary, let's face it. But we have a great show today, lots to discuss, some really good content, international news that's happening that's relevant to us, as well as an interview here on The Sector that I think you're going to really appreciate. We have with us an interview with Glenn Lamont of the HAVE Culinary Training Society, which is a social enterprise operating in the downtown east side of Vancouver. HAVE, which stands for Hope, Action, Values, and Ethics, is a culinary training school that provides food service job training and work opportunities to individuals in Vancouver who are experiencing barriers to employment. HAVE students are youth and adults who are facing mental and physical disabilities, poverty, addiction, homelessness. Now, as I mentioned, HAVE operates in the downtown east side, which, if you're unfamiliar with Vancouver, the downtown east side is one of, if not the, poorest neighborhoods in the city. In fact, it's probably one of the poorest neighborhoods in the entire country. But to simply characterize the downtown east side as merely poor really does it a disservice, because it's actually one of the most vibrant communities in terms of culture and history. In fact, the downtown east side is Vancouver's oldest neighborhood. It has some of the most beautiful heritage buildings in the city. There is history and culture. You can't throw a rock there without hitting some icon of history, some important major event in Vancouver's history would have happened in the downtown east side. It was the historic core of the city. Unfortunately, in the last 25 years, the downtown east side went through some really tough times in terms of poverty, addiction, and of course the increase in property values throughout the rest of the city, which has really pushed a lot of people who can't afford to live anywhere else into the downtown east side. Now, we're going to get into more of this in the interview with Glenn, so I just wanted to first put that out there so you're thinking about it. Again, as perceptions go, you would think the downtown east side is a very dangerous and, you know, bad place to go. But in reality, it's something completely different. And we'll talk to Glenn about this later on in the show and get a good idea of exactly what it is like to be in the downtown east side. Now, I mentioned there's been some international news across the board. Some interesting stuff relevant for our show. That, of course, is the news out of the UK, or perhaps not long to be the UK. Yes, that's right. Scotland may, in fact, be separating from the United Kingdom next week. And this is relevant to me, of course, if you happen to know what I look like, red hair, pale skin, kind of ghostish. You'll know that I have a Scottish ancestry in me. In fact, a family legend indicates that the Clows were in fact once related to Scottish royalty. I'm not exactly sure how that connection works out, but whatever, family legend. As such, it's kind of an interesting opportunity to discuss kind of the political nature of a conversation that we've had before when it comes to sort of the rights of a society versus the rights of the individual. Arguably, you can make the argument that for nations like Scotland or England or Canada, there is a sense of strength and cohesion that we get from being a united front, a nation of nations. Whereas some would argue that we actually gain a better society by having a more individualized arrangement. So, for example, in Canada, we have the federal government, and then we have the provinces, and they each have their own jurisdictions. Now, Canada has a fairly centralized government. We give a lot of power in Ottawa to govern the rest of the country. Compared to, say, America, where the states have a lot of power, they can override the federal government on many things. So there's a very interesting dichotomy there. And that can, of course, relate to some of the common themes that we've discussed on the show in terms of personal liberty. Where exactly does that end and begin in terms of health and safety, in terms of law and order? I mean, should we have a society that values the individual to such an extent that we're not even making laws about things like wearing a bike helmet or smoking laws or drug use laws? So in some sense, this is the macrocosm of that debate. We're talking about it on a grand scale. This is also relatively interesting because of the other, I think, big question in Europe, of course, is the European Union. With the financial and economic turmoil that's going on in the world, not just in Europe, but the world, it's put a lot of strain on the EU. And what was once considered, you know, the next logical step in Europe's political development is now being questioned. I mean, the idea that certain nations could abandon the euro, which could have pretty significant impacts, not just for European political power, but also, you know, world economic financial relationships. So should Scotland separate from the United Kingdom, this would end the Act of Union, which was established in 1707. And of course, prior to that, England and Scotland were two nations ruled by the same monarchy. And interestingly enough, it was actually the fourth attempt to unite the two nations. Previous attempts had been made in 1606, 1667, and 1689. And the reason that the two nations eventually did merge, of course, was that Queen Anne, who was Queen of England and Scotland at the time, well, you know, the English, they wanted to make sure that the monarchy maintained the same. They didn't want to necessarily have a king or queen of England who was of one dynasty, one house, and have a king or queen of a different dynasty or of a different house in Scotland. I mean, certainly the last thing they wanted was to have, say, the Scottish crown go to some, you know, potentially like French or Spanish monarch that could seriously damage England's security and their role in sort of a naval power and a power in Europe. So they saw this whole union thing as a way to cement their control, not just over Britannica, but also their empire that they had been crafting for the last couple of hundred years. From Scotland's point of view, they were dealing with some major financial problems, not all that dissimilar from now, I suppose, but basically the country was broke. They had heavily invested in a failed colony scheme, which had just failed miserably. So the country was in dire straits. And by merging with England, they could gain financial security as well as hone in on England's empire and merge the two nations, and their interests would also be more cemented together than they would be apart. I mean, history, of course, is littered with the wars, conflicts, and other circumstances that England and Scotland have faced in their many, many, many years of history. So, I mean, it was a practical solution that both countries saw, well, let's combine our nations as we already have the same monarch. Interestingly enough, they didn't include Ireland in this union. In fact, Ireland even sort of tried to kind of get into the union, and they both sort of pushed back, which is, again, another sort of representation of political and cultural egotism there. Now, the question, of course, was Scottish independence, which will be decided in a public referendum, which is happening on the 18th of September. So we should probably have an idea next week whether or not there is an independent Scotland or not. The question is quite simple. Should Scotland be an independent country, yes or no? And, you know, the follow-up questions, of course, is, well, what will happen if it does become a united, independent country, pardon me? There's a lot of hanging questions with that one. For one thing, what is Scotland going to do in terms of currency? Are they going to keep the pound, or are they going to adopt the euro? Is Scotland going to seek its own separate relationship with the EU? Famously, England is a member, but not a full member. They keep sort of a arm's length distance at all times. Maybe Scotland will go for a more in-depth relationship with the EU. Another big issue that's been popping up in the news a lot, of course, is what's going to happen to all the financial institutions that are located in Scotland. Banks and administrative centers, industry, that sort of thing. If these things are now operating in a new country, essentially, that's going to raise questions in terms of taxation. What about trade or tariffs? Moving goods and services outside of the country? That's all got to be decided, of course. Adopting to a new currency is going to be expensive. As such, I mean, a lot of banks, a lot of institutions are actually saying, you know, we may have to move, which could further hurt the Scottish economy, especially in a fledgling state as a new nation. One of the other interesting factors, of course, is the political ramifications. Many people have pointed to the fact that the ruling Conservatives from Parliament in England, very unpopular in Scotland, and that this is being sort of seen as the, you know, FU to England by the Scottish people, which is an interesting side effect. I mean, it's an expensive way to, you know, tell England where they can go because you're separating a country, of course, but it's not an uncommon or indeed a trivial matter. Looking to Canada, of course, we can see that there is a very similar divide between Anglo-Canada and Franco-Canada. The French in Quebec, historically more of a liberal province, but with its own unique spin. So, I mean, obviously, conservatism, not necessarily the most popular thing in Quebec right now. The driving of a wedge between our political parties could also, you know, have the same effect in Quebec, and famously has in several attempts. So, I mean, interesting question then. So what do we all think? You know, should nations have a more centralized state, or should they be more independent, like the states in America? Let us know what you think. I'd be very curious to hear our listener feedback. You can email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. And of course, we're also on Twitter at sectorpodcast, or follow me at Ethan Clow. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/sectorpodcast, and be sure to visit us at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com, where you can read our show notes and download the podcast and get all of our past episodes. Well, let's take a quick break here on the show, and we'll return after this.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, RX Comics, Red Cat Records, the Regional Assembly of Text, the Rumpus Room, the Wallflower Modern Diner, and Woo Vintage Clothing.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus, or go online to www.citr.ca. Keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure, that's what friends are for.
Shut up and listen to me right now. This is Fred Schneider, and you're listening to CITR. Shut up and listen to this radio station.
And we're back here on The Sector with me, Ethan Clow, discussing nonprofit social justice and activism. Well, let's go on to our interview with Glenn Lamont from Have Culinary Society. Joining us now on The Sector is Glenn Lamont. Glenn is a student counselor and job developer with Have Culinary Training Society. Glenn, welcome to the show, and thanks for being here.
Thanks. It's nice to be here, Ethan, on this lovely Friday afternoon.
Absolutely. So, Glenn, we've discussed on The Sector previously that there are more ways to do good in the community beyond charities or nonprofits. So why don't we start off by talking about what Have does for the community?
Well, Have is a training program and job placement program. So we're a nonprofit, but we're also a social enterprise. We do culinary training for people with barriers to employment. And then at the end of our 8-week program, we do our best to place them in suitable positions in kitchens throughout the city, sometimes throughout the province. We really very much take a hands-on approach to things. We like to think that we offer a solution and a way for people to make a decision and put it into action. You know, we're just there to facilitate. But we chose a sector of the industry that's very sustainable. There are always jobs out there. So we never have a problem filling positions. But mostly what we do is, you know, give people a hand up instead of a handout.
And how did you get involved with Have, and what do you do there?
Well, my job is a student counselor. So we are, as I said, we work with people with barriers to employment. So, and a barrier, I mean, that's a hugely broad term, right? I think because we're in the downtown east side, people automatically assume, you know, mental health and addiction is the only things that we deal with. And we do deal with that, but we deal with so much more. We deal with English as a second language. Age can be a barrier. We deal with people with learning disabilities. Anything that is going to stop you from competing on a level playing field with the rest of society when it comes to employment, when it comes to accessing services, any of those things, that's what we consider to be a barrier. So my job is to supplement the culinary training with life skills training, with one-on-one counseling if need be, communication skills, visualization, goal setting, all those kind of things, money management, anything that I can think of that is going to help somebody to seamlessly make that transition back into the workforce, or maybe into the workforce for the very first time. And then I also do the job development, which kind of fell into my lap. That's not what my position started out to be. But I started with Have originally in 2009, and I actually went through the Have program myself. I had just come back. I was over in the UK for 10 years, and I'd come back to Canada and was kind of just kicking around. And so I went through the program, and Amber Anderson, our executive director, offered me a job as an instructor to stay on. And in that time that I was with them as an instructor, you know, I spent more time dealing with personal issues with the students than I did actually teaching cooking. And well, plus I'm not a very good cook either, so that kind of had something to do with it. So we'd agreed. We'd always said, her and I, that whenever there was funding available for the position of counselor, that that she would offer that to me right away. So I left on medical leave. I went and had an operation. I worked on another project in the downtown east side, a community development project. I went back to school for counseling psychology. And then and when some money came back, came through for funding, they gave me a call. And so we always knew that position was really essential, but there was just never any money for it. But we're doing okay now, so you know, it's worked out really well, and have just seems to be you know, I'm very, very much connected to the program, having been through it, but I'm also very connected to it because my background is the same essentially as many of the students that come through. I struggled with my own addiction for 25 years, and I'm a pretty smart guy, I like to think, anyways. But regardless, you know, that addiction took my career. It took me to all the places that I never thought I would be, including homeless, on the street, in jail, in hospitals, you know, till I was finally at my very, very, very bottom. And that's when I got sober. So when a person comes through our door and that's their background, you know, right away we have a lot of common ground there. And it's also nice to be able to say that to a student, to a potential, you know, success story, to be able to say, you know, dude, 8.5 years ago, I was you, mm-hmm. but I am now doing what I love and getting paid to do it. So that is, in a long-winded way, how I got involved with that.
Well, excellent. And so for listeners who may not be familiar with the downtown east side in Vancouver, it's one of the city's poorest neighborhoods. It's one of the poorest in the countries, but there's a very strong sense of community activism. So Glenn, what would you say is the downtown east side's defining characteristics?
Well, some words I might use to describe the downtown east side. You know, number one that most people don't think about that comes to mind for me is community. There's a very, very strong sense of community there. This is people's backyards. This is people's neighborhoods. People forget that a lot of families live in the downtown east side. Mostly the press, you know, anytime they do a story, we're misrepresented as just this, you know, this ghetto, and it's all about the addiction issues and the street drugs and the poverty and lack of housing and all these things. All these things are an issue, absolutely, but you will never meet a sector of this city that has a stronger sense of community than the downtown east side. You know, it's the oldest neighborhood in the city. It's the last affordable place to live. And it can be, you know, there are days when I look at that city and, you know, that part of the city, the downtown east side, and there are days when I just see all the misery and the pain. And at the same time, I have met some of the most talented, some of the smartest, some of the most amazing, wonderful people that I've ever had the pleasure to meet, and I've traveled a lot, you know. They're all right there in that small area. You know, and there's so many, you know, small businesses that have been there for decades. And so, you know, the downtown east side is many, many things. Yes, it is, you know, one of the poorest neighborhoods in the nation. Yet at the same time, you know, it has a real sense of strength with the people who live there. It has a real, you know, authenticity to it that you're not going to find in any other part of the city. put it this way, I don't think you're going to be seeing a Starbucks anytime soon.
Well, that actually kind of leads me to my next question. There's been a lot of new development, new businesses, new people moving into the downtown east side, and it's raised a lot of discussion and debate about the community. What is your sense on this new development in the downtown east side, and how is it affecting, you know, doing good in the downtown east side?
Well, geez, that's a lot of questions all in one, really. So first of all, the gentrification thing, you know, it's happening. I don't see really a way around it. And when I say that, I'm not on either side of the fence. I'm an observer on this one. I see it happening. And you know, the bottom line is, for many, 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 many years, it was convenient for the downtown east side to be a ghetto. It was convenient for the, you know, for all parties involved. We will put all the services down there. We know where all those people are at all times. So, you know, good middle class citizens know not to go there, unless, of course, you know, it's 3 o'clock on a Saturday morning and they're trying to score drugs. So it's always been convenient, right? But then what happened was, with the way real estate has gone in Vancouver, there's no place left to go. You know, million-dollar homes are a normal thing here now. And so it's the last place for developers to go as well. And when developers who have money want in, you know, there's really no stopping them. So to be able to find a balance is going to be the greatest challenge. And when I say balance, I really mean a balance. I don't mean, you know, allowing these new developments to come in and just take over. I mean, there needs to be people who, you know, are going to be living side by side, and they're going to need to find a way to do that, because, as I said, it's the last affordable place in the city. There's a huge number of seniors in the downtown east side. There are families down there, and there's nothing you can do about that. So that needs to be taken in consideration. So, you know, really the city, the provincial government, and specifically the federal government really needs to step up to the plate on the housing issue. You know, so as far as how our little enterprise fits into that, you know, we don't have much to do with the politics down there. We have a program that is free, and because we're a program for people with barriers, we don't have any barriers to get into the program. We're an ongoing intake. A student comes in, a potential student comes in, we chat for 5 or 10 minutes, we get them to fill out the paperwork, and then we say, okay, you start Monday. And they're always amazed by that. They're like, you mean this Monday? Because they're used to being told you're on a waiting list. They're right. Used to being told we'll call you, or we just got to process your forms. And you lose people in that time. When an individual makes a decision to do something with their life, you have a very, very short window of opportunity to help them. Because they've had doors slammed in their faces all their lives. They've been told nothing but no, and you're not good enough, and you're pretty useless, so why bother? So if they do happen to wander through our door, and we caught them on that day that they decided, I'm going to make a big change, we want to facilitate that as soon as possible. And what we do, we know works. We're not huge, so we're not this big factory turning out, you know, potential Gordon Ramsays of the future on a weekly basis. We do what we can with what we have. But having said that, you know, in the last 7 years, since 2007, we have trained and found employment for a little over 600 individuals, most of whom were previously on income assistance. So we don't see ourselves going anywhere, gentrification or no gentrification, because that is, that's our home. People know us. We get lots of people coming by on a regular basis. We have our regular clientele who eats there, people from the courthouse, people from some of the nonprofits who work down there. We get a lot of people who come in that, they could eat elsewhere because there are some pretty nice places to eat, like Railtown Cafe and places like that. But they choose to come and support what we do at HAP.
Well, I've seen your reviews on Yelp and the Urban Spoon, so they're very good.
Well, for the most part, we don't get too many people complaining. The students, they're well supervised, but everything that is on that menu is prepared by the students. When we have a really busy day, they're in there giving it all they've got, and they're very nervous, they want to get the food out on time. They want it to be the best possible quality. And it's one of the reasons our program works, because we have that restaurant and because we have catering contracts. It's totally hands-on for the student from day one. On their very first day, they're right into the kitchen. And it's the best way to learn. For the students, it's an 8-week program. For them, they're like, oh my God, 8 weeks. And for us, we're like, oh my God, 8 weeks. Because for us, it's not a long time to take a person, evaluate their barriers, train them, and try and remove as many barriers as possible, and send them back out into the world. But it's an amazing array of individuals that come to our program. Amazing, especially when we get, I love it when we get success stories. And our success stories are usually the people that, when they're walking through those doors, you can't help it, but you interview them and then they leave and you think, oh my God, not a hope in hell does this person have. And they're always the ones that surprise you. And we love it when somebody gets a job and, they come back to us in 6 months to say, I moved. I've got an apartment. I got a salary increase. They're bumping me up to a better position. It's a lot of hard work for everyone, mostly the students. And we have a lot of frustration and, there's just a lot of passion and effort goes into what we do, but when we have our successes, it makes it all worthwhile.
And so as a social enterprise, HAP operates with a concept of the blended return on investment. So tell us a bit about that, and how do you weigh things like your return on investment, and how do you measure success and that sort of thing?
Well, really, we're kind of a hybrid. So one thing I have to say is that social enterprises are very, very new. People are still getting used to that idea. And they still haven't, Revenue Canada still has not really classified all that or straightened all that out with how taxes work for a social enterprise. So for us, the HAP Culinary Training Society is a nonprofit registered charity. but we're also a social enterprise because we have a restaurant and we have catering contracts, and the revenue from both those enterprises goes directly back into our program, and our program is training individuals and finding them employment. So that's what qualifies us as a social enterprise. So there, you know, there is return on investment. You know, I know you're referring to partners, but we don't really have any. So we're a little bit different in that respect.
Yeah, and you're right that the social enterprise is a sort of a new creature in the realm of the nonprofit and charities. What's been your perception of, you know, the traditional nonprofit working in the downtown east side compared to like a new kind of nonprofit like yours? Have you seen better results?
Yeah, absolutely. To me, I really honestly believe it's the way forward. You know, people get upset with me when I'm at different, well, actually, they stopped inviting me to a lot of meetings and rallies, especially because I throw around the E word, which nobody wants to hear, and the E word is enabling. So the thing is, there are too many food lineups. There are too many free clothing places. There is just far too much stuff that goes on in the downtown east side that keeps people in the cycle of poverty. You know, mind you, it also employs a lot of people, and that's part of the issue as well. We need to find ways that are empowering for people who want to make the change, for people who want to break the cycle of poverty. They need a way to do that. So we really need to figure out ways that we can help people, you know, that we can facilitate those changes. And at the same time, so when you look at what we do, okay, so you take an individual who's on income assistance. And the last figures that I got were it costs about $55,000 per year per person to keep a person on income assistance, you know, and that includes healthcare costs and all those things. So now we take an individual, we train them, we place them appropriately, and we follow them, right? You know, we track what goes on there. We try and have a really good relationship with the employer. We want to make sure they succeed. You know, for their own sake and for our sake. So now we've taken that person who's no longer, you know, no longer on income assistance, no longer, you know, that $55,000 a year burden on the taxpayer, and they are now working, they are now paying taxes, they are now contributing to the local economy. We ourselves, you know, when it comes to the food we serve, we try our absolute best to source everything locally. I know that those guys in the kitchen there, Chef Lloyd and Glenda and the other people who work in, take the students down every day, every single morning to Sunrise Market just down the road from us, and buy all the fresh produce there, you know. So we try, really the goal is to make it a win-win for everybody, right? So this is not a make-work program. And this is certainly not, you know, I know none of us at HAVE are going to be retiring early. But, you know, we want it to be that everybody is contributing and everybody is succeeding.
And what sort of challenges does an operation like HAVE face?
You know, lots. Wow. It's, you know, I'm going to say this in answer to your question. I totally sounded like a politician right there. I'm going to ignore your question, but I'm going to say this. That I think one of the biggest things that we do at HAV is we change people's perceptions of what a person with a barrier is. We change people's perception of what a recovering addict is all about. We change people's perceptions of what, you know, English as a second language, you know, foreign students are, whatever the barrier. Because what happens is when I have to go out and speak to, you know, executive chefs and general managers and business owners to tell them what we do, you know, at HAV, and to also find out what kind of a company they are all about, that we can hopefully come to an understanding and they can hire one of our students. But try and understand that if you're a businessman, you own a restaurant, and you have lots of alcohol and lots of cash, and I'm saying to you, here's a guy who is just such an awesome hard worker, and he's done so well in our program, and he spent 25 years in prison for killing a guy, but he's an awesome worker, and you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Now, he's going to look at that and go, wow, that's kind of a risk that I'm taking, you know? But the owners and the managers who take that risk have never been disappointed. So we have now changed that person's perception, because what's going to happen is the next time they find themselves in a situation, maybe in a social situation, and the subject comes up, they are qualified to talk about it. You know what I mean? They can now say, hey, you're wrong, because I got a guy working for me who, you know, these are his issues, but you know what? He is the best employee I have ever had, and I wish I had 5 more like him. So now he's changing other people's perceptions, and I think that it's a huge part of what we do, right?
Mm-hmm.
We want people to see that this is not a problem with no end in sight. You know, there are ways to change it, and the way to do that is by giving people a chance and putting some trust in them, and letting them go to it, right? And really, are the numbers speak for themselves. So we really do. We have far more successes than we do. Well, I'm not even going to use the word failure, because we have an open door policy. If it doesn't work out, you know, you come back again. We've had people through our program 2 and 3 times. And it's usually the ones who take two or three runs at it that are usually the most successful.
Well, as we're wrapping up, let's go to one of our favorite questions, which is the pitch of the week. And this is where we ask our guests for their best elevator pitch, their best 30 seconds to a minute pitch for a charity or a cause of their choice. So, Glenn, what would you pitch the world?
I would definitely pitch HAV. So we are, you know what, I'll give you my pitch, that when I'm making my cold calls, and most chefs who are incredibly busy all the time, you know, they only give you about 30 seconds. So, you know, my thing is, you know, my name's Glenn. I'm calling from HAV Culinary Training Society. I don't know if you've heard about us, but we are a nonprofit registered charity and social enterprise, and we do culinary training for people with barriers to employment. We've been around since 2007. In that time, we have trained over 600 individuals who were previously deemed unemployable. We have our own restaurant. We have our own catering contracts. Our students are trained by not one, but 2 certified chef de cuisine. That's as high as you can go. That's higher than a Red Seal chef. They're getting, you know, the exact same quality of training that they would get at VCC or the Art Institute or any of those places. We are all about our two passions, and those passions are people and food. And we think we do both of those really, really well. And we would love for you to come down and see what we do firsthand and try our food and meet our students and see what a person with a barrier actually looks, walks, and talks like. And we almost guarantee that you will go away a changed individual for having spent the afternoon with us.
Excellent. That's great. So finally, Glenn, for those who are interested, what's the best way to get involved or learn more about HAVE?
We have a website, which is www.have-cafe.ca. You can come down and visit us. Our restaurant is open to the public Monday to Friday, 8 till 2 in the afternoon, 8 in the morning till 2. We actually have an event coming up in November that we do every once in a while called Amber and Friends, and we bring in a celebrity guest for the night, and it's a fundraiser to help our program. So you can check us out on the web, or you can come down and see us in person, and you can ask for me, and I will happily give you a little tour of our school and show you what we do. And I guarantee the food is awesome. So, and big portions.
Awesome. Fantastic. Well, Glenn, thank you so much for joining us on The Sector, and please visit us again in the future.
Okay, that's awesome. We expect to see you down there too, Ethan.
Oh, I'll be there.
Okay, thank you.
Jazz is a word that means many different things to many different people. The best definition of jazz that I know of is the jazz show on CITR with yours truly, Gavin Walker. Monday nights, 9 to midnight, with the jazz feature at 11 o'clock. Check us out every Monday.
Ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
That's one small step for man.
So vote.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
And we are back here on The Sector with me, Ethan Clow. Well, we're running out of time here once again on the show. So my thanks to Glenn Lamont from HAVE, the Culinary Training Society, for joining us on the show to tell us a bit about their operation as a social enterprise and all of the great stuff that they're doing in the Downtown East Side, helping everybody out down there. Fantastic work. If you want to learn more about HAVE, Tune into our show notes posted at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. I'll have a link to Hav's website where you can get more information, as well as visit their restaurant and help out the community a little bit. Remember, if you want to subscribe to the podcast or download past episodes, you can also do that at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. And of course, we'd love to get your feedback on today's show. Email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com or visit us on Facebook at facebook.com/sectorpodcast. And of course, we're on Twitter at sectorpodcast and at Ethan Clow. That's me. Remember to tune in next week on the show, Fridays 8 a.m. our usual time, where we'll have more social justice, more nonprofit, more activism talk to sate your every desire for the world of progressive politics and making the world a better place. Until then, thank you for tuning in, and we will see you next week. Have a fantastic weekend, everybody.
I take two. Okay.